Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and the host of this series. I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. Today, we'll be continuing our exploration of the social significance of awakening by considering the unique spiritual perspectives of Adida Samraj, as expressed in his book, Not Two Is Peace. And I'll be talking about that with Frank Marrero. As you may know, I've convened this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep and diverse public dialogue about how spirituality can play a key role in helping us find the inner resources that can enable us and other human beings to rise to the challenges of our world crises so that we can transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. We've had a series of profound and enlivening conversations in which we've focused on many specific aspects of this question. The way this will work today is that I'll do something special. I'll take a few minutes right at the beginning of this call to say something about my longtime teacher and root guru, Adida. And then I'll proceed as I always do, and I'll introduce my guest, Frank. And then we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements, and we'll finish up by spending about half an hour taking your questions, and then we'll finish up. The whole call will take a little more than 90 minutes. So as regular listeners of this series know, my spiritual master was Adida Samraj. And some of you are aware that he's an incredibly controversial figure. He's seen by some as the most enlightened God-man who ever lived, a divine manifestation, an unparalleled spiritual, philosophical, literary, and artistic genius, the creator of a body of spiritual teaching so sublime and fragrant and extensive. In terms of the extensiveness, they can only be compared with that of a whole spiritual school like Soto Zen or Kagyu Vajrayana, Tibetan Buddhism. It's so far beyond the output in terms of substance and rigor of any other spiritual teacher in history. He's the bearer of a spiritual transmission that the world desperately, desperately needs right now. But he's also seen by others as the worst kind of narcissistic cult leader, a preposterous abuser, a man who used his genius to exploit his followers, a poster boy for the egregious abuse of spiritual authority. And compounding that, we live in a time when many intelligent people declare the age of the guru is over, a time in which the idea that a collective awakening is necessary is upon us. It's obviously something I'm very interested in, something I talk about. But it's also a time in which the profundity of the authentic guru yoga, whatever that is seems to be incomprehensible. The credibility of anybody who respects and values a guru is deemed suspect, and anything communicated in that context is regarded by many as being a priori unworthy of deeper examination. And, you know, this is true even though all the most profound expressions of human wisdom from the past have come to us in that very fashion, from Jesus or Gautama, or really from any tradition, from a great realizer who transmitted his or her awakened consciousness directly, mind to mind, heart to heart, to one or more of their students. Now, most of those who have been deeply influenced by Adida have found it difficult, if not impossible, to speak about him publicly in a way that conveys anything worthwhile and can really be heard by others. So he remains mostly unknown, and even now, in the larger public conversation, almost a curiosity or an esoteric secret seemingly forgotten, despite the enormous and mostly unacknowledged influence that he's had on contemporary spirituality and our contemporary spiritual conversation. Think of ideas such as the idea that ego is not an entity, but an activity, or the self-contraction, or the phrase, always already, or the idea that the end of the path is the way from the beginning, or the idea of stages of spiritual awakening, the seven stages of life, all these seminal phrases and insights entered our contemporary spiritual conversation through Adi Da. And then there are other huge evidences of his genius, like his remarkable sacred image art. As a matter of spiritual integrity, I have always acknowledged Adi Da and spoken with deep respect and love and gratitude about the enormous transformative gifts he has given me. And at the same time, I've never concealed that I hold many critical perspectives, too. I've never regretted that I've devoted my life to him, that I did for 15 years, from the time I was 22 to 37. But I also feel and have always felt entirely congruent with my painful decision to leave the cultic confines of his formal community for the last 20 years of his life. Adi Da is truly, even now after his passing, a unique figure, larger than life. And to speak about him is really difficult. It's to nominate oneself as one of the blind men in the Indian fable, groping the tusk or leg or tail of the elephant and reporting to the emperor some partial view of something much more rich and complex than they could perceive. In my experience, Adi Da was two parts Jesus Christ, one part Picasso, one part Nagarjuna, one part Marlon Brando, and one part Genghis Khan. And more. My heart resonates completely with those of my many old friends who have spent their whole lives as his completely committed devotees. And yet I empathize passionately with many other dear friends who number themselves among his most severe and even harshest critics. Somehow in my being, neither of these resonances even slightly diminishes the other. In my teacher, I witnessed a miracle that's beyond comprehension. My encounter with him transformed my consciousness, and in some ways, it was brutal. And I saw his encounters with others mostly uplift their lives in beautiful ways, but also seemingly hurt people, and that really bothered me, and it still does. It confronted me with impossible paradoxes that deepened my being way beyond anything I can put into words. And I'll be eternally grateful for that. And even so, my way of expressing my devotion is often defiant and critical. All that being said, I think our contemporary spiritual conversation, including the all-important conversation that's the focus of this Beyond Awakening teleseries about how higher consciousness can enable us to rise to meet the challenges of our current world in crisis, can be enormously deepened if more people take the time to drink deeply of Adi Da's amazingly profound spiritual transmission and teachings. There are two spiritual giants who are no longer in the body whose influence needs to be felt more fully in this series. The first is Adi Da Samraj, and the second is Sri Aurobindo. In a future dialogue, I hope to explore the remarkable influence of Sri Aurobindo. In this dialogue, I've asked Frank Marrero to join me to discuss our master, the remarkable, sublime, wild, brilliant, radiant, heartbreakingly beautiful Adi Da Samraj. Now, let me introduce Frank. Hey, Frank. I want to say a few words about you here before we begin. Unlike some of our guests, Frank is not already a well-known public teacher, but he is a remarkable human being. He's an illumined mystic, an infectious storyteller in the good old Tennessee tradition, and a fifth-grade public school teacher in the San Francisco Bay Area, here where we both live. He's been an adjunct instructor at the Department of Philosophy and Religion at John F. Kennedy University since 2002. And he's written an innovative and rigorous integral affective educational curriculum, including character education, emotional fluency, moral values, and self-awareness, called Big Philosophy for Little Kids. He's also a profound scholar of ancient Greece and the author of two books, Recollections of Socrates and The View from Delphi, an ecstatic appreciation of Western history. And these original writings have been endorsed and highly praised by Norman O. Brown, Michael Murphy, Richard Tarnas, and the director of the Joseph Campbell Foundation, as well as hundreds of grateful teachers and students. Frank lived for over a decade as a renunciate in the ashram of Adidas Samraj, where he studied not just Adidas' enormous body of teachings, but also many spiritual traditions, particularly Hinduism and Buddhism. He was also exposed to potent spiritual transmission, akin to the initiations of the ancient mysteries and Shaktipat Diksha. He was the first director of children's education in Adidas Ashram, and he's the proud father of two bright and happy children, 16-year-old Salem and 12-year-old Ella. His website is frankmarrero.com. Now, that only tells part of the story of Frank, however. He's really a remarkable human being in another sense, too. To grasp what Frank is really like, it'd be good to understand that he came into this world with an extraordinary level of organismic radiance. Literally from his babyhood, he was an amazing specimen of physical capacity, integrated whole body, athletic genius and courage. He was on TV in Nashville, Tennessee, where he grew up, at the age of two for diving off the high dive into the municipal pool by the Parthenon at Vanderbilt University. In high school, he became the first hang glider pilot east of the Mississippi. He also set all the strength and endurance in many of the athletic records in his high school and was really doing extreme sports before they'd been invented. He learned to swing on ropes in a way that far exceeded anything Johnny Weissmuller, the guy who played Tarzan, ever dreamed of doing. And diving, doing elaborate tricks from high precipices, sort of like the famed divers of Acapulco. To give you a sense of what he was capable of, he free-climbed Yosemite Falls. Those of you who know what that's like, that nobody in their right mind would do that. And we could argue about whether he was in his right mind, but his physical intelligence, he knew he could. Moreover, he lived outdoors for 2 years, year-round, in Tennessee when it snowed, before global warming, growing and slaughtering his own food and cutting his own firewood for 2 years without using power tools, just because he could, interested to vitally feel and know his relationship to the natural world. He was also uncannily intelligent, with nearly photographic memory and uncanny mathematical abilities. He'd already enjoyed great success in his mid-20s when he sold two very successful businesses in Nashville and moved to California to study with Adidas. So in the 30 years that I've known Frank, he's become my dear, dear best buddy, Bhagavan. We've really been awakened together in many ways. I share a deep spiritual love relationship with Frank. I've watched him open up to the intuitive genius that gave him mystical insight into the Orphics and the pre-Socratics, and out of which all his books have poured forth. He's also incredibly playful and outrageous and freely embraces the archetype of the enlightened fool and is just an incredibly spontaneous and unselfconscious guy. There's so many things I love about Frank, but one of them is that he's just one of the happiest, most radiant, generous, kind, entertaining human beings I've ever met. Now, we both appreciate the profound and diverse and paradoxical perspectives that one can take on Adidas Samraj, but it's Frank's nature to speak without qualification as a joyful, adoring devotee, and that's one of the reasons I've invited him to join me here today. I'm proud and delighted to introduce all of you who are listening to Frank, and especially through him, to bring forth the electrifying voice and transmission of Adidas into this remarkable ongoing public dialogue about the future of spiritual practice in these remarkably interesting and turbulent times. So, with all that said, welcome, Frank. I'm really happy to have you.
Thank you, Jerry, you sweetheart.
Well, it's all true.
Yes, I don't say it. I ain't true. I'm in his right mind.
So, is there anything you want to say before we launch in, Frank?
I would like to tell a little bit of thank you, Terry. You know, you've been dearest, beloved to me, and I thank you for that introduction that shows me in all my foolishness and ridiculousness. So thank you so much.
Well, yeah, so you were saying you might want to tell us something about maybe your relationship to Adi Dar, how you got to know him. Why don't you begin just by kind of opening up, yeah.
Mm-hmm, sure. Well, as you mentioned, I was a moderately wealthy, successful business young man in Nashville, Tennessee. And I, with the free time that I had from that, continued my studies of philosophy and religious texts, and I ran across Adi Da, and I thought, my God, this guy is brilliant. And I was first and mostly taken by his penetrating insights, particularly into the structure and the root responsibilities of the ego or self. And I was just, I'd never read anything like that, and I'd, you know, for my age, I had read lots at that time, and so I proceeded to read him a lot until I came out here and visited, and I was heartened by the fact that when I got here, nobody was going, oh, you found the guru, no one, oh, you know, everybody was going, yeah, who are you, why do you think you belong, you know, it was not the batting-eyed cultic thing I'd feared. It was, in fact, all my doubts were supported. And nevertheless, I kept my distance because no matter how brilliant I thought he was, there was this, he kept talking about his God realization and he was God. And I was like, you know, as we all should be, very suspicious about that kind of talk. And I heartily join anyone and everyone who would be suspicious about that kind of talk, as I was. But nevertheless, I moved closer and closer until I realized that to really see what it was, and I'd seen enough to actually sell everything I owned and come live with him in his ashram or nearby. But without all my doubts, with my core doubts still fully intact. And I, even though I witnessed magnificent and amazing and was transported in varieties of ways, I did not relinquish that until after about 2 years of being here, I was subsumed in a spiritual magnificence and glory that was so heart core, so blissfully loving presence that I was like, I finally realized that he was not just smart. He was not just brilliant. He was a transmitter of spiritual being, which is my, quote unquote, my own being. And that was his greatness of his transmission. It was not like Shaktipat, like I'm getting fireworks all through my body or anything like that, although there was times of that as well. But the core of my being, the core of I am, was enlarged to the degree of infinity. That's when I realized, okay. And so then I could understand his confession of God realization and God transmitting from the inside out. So that's the first 4 years of my being with him. And then I spent another 8 years in his tight in, including 5 months in a small room with him, which was spiritual beyond my wildest dreams. And I had wild dreams. So I came to him, and he not only baptized and blessed and blissed me, he, like you said, he was ruthless about rendering self-understanding, and altogether uncomfortably so. But I hung with it, as it were, and came to the other side. So I understand also why people would not be so enthusiastic about and suspicious. But for me, that fiery magnificence brought me to my knees in eternally. So that's my. Then he set me off not only on the children, talking about children and studying children. And not only did he require us all to study in depth Buddhism and Hinduism, and Christianity particularly, but also the philosophical systems of the West, and particularly he asked me to study the pre-Socratic mystery schools, which I did. And that's how I came to what I consider my two arms. One is children's education, education in general, and the sacred origins of Western civilization.
Yeah, and you've written some pretty remarkable books and just even phrases and writings in that regard. And you know, it might be good, Frank, for you to speak a little bit here about how Adi Da's influence has actually, you know, awakened your mystical insight. Because it was really, you know, as I watched it unfold, this study of the Greeks was, you know, at a certain point, you know, your kind of inner eye of mystical vision was opened up, and you were able to see into, you know, like Norman O. Brown's comment, you know, I had to study and study and study to get these insights, and somehow they seemed to flow naturally from you. And it was really that you had been awakened through your time with Adi Da in a way that you were you kind of tuned in and you saw what the enlightened expression was of the Orphics and the pre-Socratics.
That's right.
And you were able to kind of see what they were really talking about. It might be kind of cool to talk about that in a little more depth.
Well, when Adi Da had me study the pre-Socratics and the mystery schools, I didn't do it from a mere academic point of view. Adi Da had, by his word and glance and touch, had initiated in me and given to me in abundance a host of spiritual understandings, spiritual experience, spiritual realizations, temporary, given my naive and undeveloped stage, but nevertheless, the gifts were given. And so when I would read the texts, the pre-Socratic and the mystery traditions, particularly in Orphism, I would understand them with a slightly different angle. So when they would talk about transmission, for instance, in Orphism, I knew what that meant. It wasn't a ceremony. It was not a mere effect of presence or intoxicants or anything else. I understood it from the inside out by his transmission. So I started assembling all this information from a different, with a different point of view, with a different angle, and it wasn't merely an academic recapitulation, regurgitation. It was, oh, they mean this. Oh, they mean that. Because I had been in embrace of a realizer and a transmitter. So my own awakenings that came out of those gifts, humble though they may have been, they were extraordinary in ordinary sense. And so I...
Well, maybe you could talk about, it might be interesting, the way this might come through most effectively,
mm-hmm,
would be
sure.
if you spoke about something in particular? Like, for instance, there are, you know, you can recite many passages, both from Adi Da's writings and from your own, that are, you know, particularly expressive. You might kind of talk about one of those particular passages or insights and how that lit up. That might be a way to kind of make this come alive a little more fully.
Well, okay. Well, let me put it this way. I was I have disabilities. I have very, very, very terrible fine motor skills, and I can't handwrite. And because of that, in my early schooling, I could not write because I couldn't handwrite, and I was math and science whiz, and so they just passed me through. And I even then, when I got to college, I had to drop out because I can't write at all. And
by the way, you're a gross motor skills genius. You know, you backflips with double twists. So it's kind of an interesting paradox: a disability with an ability.
I guess that's how it works sometimes. And so I being a functional illiterate, I mean, I could read well, but I could not write a thing. And so I remember one day, May 23rd, 1987, I was sitting by the lake up behind my house with you, and all of a sudden I was touched by your love and his love, and I fell into utter darkness. And I could only do that because I was so held. I was loved, even though all the nastiness that I am was obvious to you and him. And that was not just an ordinary psychological, wasn't just an ordinary psychological maturation that would allow that. I felt actually through it into all time, all darkness. And I just bolted upright, and waves and waves and waves of information. And I described it as I got a green card to the Akashic Library of all knowledge. And I went home and I sat down at the computer and I wrote, now this is from an illiterate: language, like every other growing body, is a living, breathing process, and words, every one and all, are vibrantly alive, each echoing a long lineage of sound and reflection. This aural inheritance can be sung and followed as we reach back to a distant time of simpler sounds and simpler meanings. Speech may suddenly loom symphonic in a dance of form and feeling, even carry you away into a time of musing and ancient understanding. While there are a few words that remain unchanged by even millennia, most words are the product of seasoned transformation and growth, and all word sounds communicate, even if unbeknownst to our verbal minds, their deep roots. Now, I just wrote that like that. There was no notes, there was no thought. I just started writing. And so then I went on to write several books. And that was a spontaneous a gift from him, that I could go from having to drop out of school because I couldn't write a paragraph to fairly good rhapsody. So does that help you?
Yeah, that's great. It gives us a feeling. Oh, wonderful. Well, the title of this dialogue is supposed to be, the title is Prior Unity, the Radical Truth mm-hmm. that Will Transform Our World. And so, you know, we're supposed to really talk about Adi Da's perspectives on the thesis of this series, you know.
Yes.
So what does that title mean, Prior Unity, the Radical Truth that Will Transform Our World?
Well, that's from a book, his book called Not Two Is Peace. And the ordinary people's way of global cooperative order. Just let me start with the title here. The not two is peace. It makes me immediately think back to the Upanishads, where it says, "Wherever there is an other, fear arises," and that's a basic structure in our human psyche and psychology, that when we conceive or perceive others, that there's a a basic distrust, a basic fear, a basic us and them sensation. And that is holding the world in this awful situation. They have this current World 7 situation. We've become fragmented into each of our own separateness. And we came out of a world, you know, here we are in the 21st century. It wasn't that long ago. Most of human history was in everybody in their own province, even their own valley. And so everything over the hill, alien, foreign, we have whatever the bad word for rich is, we have a plethora of structures in our psyche that say, oh, those people over there, watch out, you know, don't trust, have fear, for the most part. And so this has evolved from what Adida calls tribal, that's what Adida would call tribalism, which is that kind of me sense in the small collective at first, and then in larger collectives, as he points out, this tribalism is now seen as nation states. So now, back in each of these tribal times, everybody had a sense of what would be absolute or unifying, but they were exclusivist and absolutist claims. And or as I like to, since I'm a fifth grade teacher, I characterize it as my daddy's bigger than your daddy. And now, without being facetious, that kind of sentiment is riddles the world. And that we have the tribalism, which is the ego and collective form. So we don't operate on the assumption that we are one family. Now, science has now finally, quote unquote, proven that we are one human family, that we are, that there is a singular humanity. But we still operate on the presumption of difference, of us and them. So this root understanding that, in other words, we have to come first of all to a very sober appreciation of how we live in disunity, how we have this us them otherness. We have to feel profoundly.
Personally, and even in our own way of perceiving existence, apart from looking at somebody else as an other, just my way of perceiving the tree across the way is a subject-object division that is a two-ness, not a not-two-ness.
That's right. It's and as you point out, this is not just in relational terms. It's also in the world process terms, we've gone from a deification model to a reification or a reification model, where everything has this otherness. Everything has otherness, and we objectify everything and everyone in this isolated disunity. And it's not really thoroughly, it's not inspected. And what we have to come to see that this tribalized world is not just, I think Ken Wilber would call that tribalization or tribalism, we call it ethnocentric. So it's that ethnocentric, like I make fun of it, my daddy's bigger than your daddy, my nation's better than your side, our team is better than your team. All those kinds of continual assertions of disunity riddle the planet with coming upon a horrific crisis, and it is rooted in everybody meditating on me, on my family.
Right, but that even penetrates some of the world-centric perspectives, like the scientistic points of view, where we're using reason and we're thinking about the world in a whole world way, and we're not so racist or sexist or nationalistic. We can still be profoundly locked in an egoic mind that is essentially still divided, and right. disconnected. So it's not just ethnocentric divided mind, but even so-called world-centric divided mind that is part of what Adi Da means when he talks about tribalism. He includes the modernists too.
Absolutely right, exactly. We have to get to the point where we understand our separativeness. We understand how we separate from each other, how we separate both personally, first and foremost, and start with, but also in collectives, my tribe, my state, my nation, my point of view, my religion, that has to be released. And we have to see that it has not worked. We have to see that, you know, as individuals doing things for, you know, number one, it doesn't work. It doesn't make you happy. It doesn't bring about the satisfaction that you think is going to happen. We have to come to a disillusioned. We have to be disillusioned from our self-satisfaction seeking, and that only when we can sober appreciate. Only when we can soberly appreciate how we have enacted this separativeness, both individually and collectively, can we choose something else. So what he is proposing is not a program, a everybody get on board, but he calls it prior unity. So on the basis of a sober appreciation of our politics, both personal and political, of separativeness and disunity, we see what is actually already the case. And that is that there is a prior unity. We do not come into the world, we come out of it. We do not, there's no going to be no golden age coming. We come out of a world, cosmo, altogether inherent unified process. Much like the easy image to keep in mind for this is waves on an ocean. We are each waves on an ocean, and we may think we're very particular and identifiable, but there is an ocean beneath us. That is our actual substance. We live actually in unity, all of us. And guess what? Not only do we live in unity, it's even better than that in some sense. We are one family. If we'll start to feel that first, then we will treat others, quote unquote, in like family, even if it's Wicked Uncle Ernie, even if it's our, you know, funny cousin, even if it's our whatever it is, we will treat people differently if we come with the presumption of our inherent unifying prior unity. If we will feel that first,
so that even if we're relating to someone who is sociopathic and totally untrustable and dangerous, we're somehow still not losing that sense that they are a part of our larger family and, in a sense, body.
That's right. And a native and natural compassion will arise. And if we will presume that...
It's sort of like the kind of compassion the Dalai Lama is always talking about trying to have for the Chinese who are kind of trying to commit a cultural genocide on everything he lives for.
Mm-hmm. Right. A magnificent expression of that, yes. What Adi Da means by prior unity is this inherent reality unity, not some golden age past, not some retro romantic you know thing where we're always back when we all lived together. It's not that kind of prior. It's a priori. It is the priorness of the unity of actual reality, because there is a conscious force, universal conscious force, that is acausal, absolute. Everything is arising as a modification of that, like waves in the ocean, everything. Let's find out how to feel that presumption. Let's understand how we obstruct and divert and step away from our inherent unity with each other and the world process.
Well, that understanding of how we step away from that unity is something that people who might be listening to this broadcast, people who are spiritual practitioners, people who have a practice, who meditate,
yeah,
you know, might be tuning into naturally already. But there's 7 billion people on the planet, and a lot of them are very, very far from even having any interest in listening to a conversation like this.
That's
so
right.
But the prior unity includes them just as much as it does those who are more capable of understanding these higher philosophical spiritual points. And isn't the whole discussion of prior unity about something that could include, like this phrase, everybody all at once? It would not only be for the highly developed elite who might be, you know, candidates for some kind of spiritual awakening, it'd be for everybody. And in
yeah,
some way, an expression of that prior unity is possible without everybody awakening fully.
That's true. But and you bring up several points there, but let me just go to the simplest. We do not have to get everybody to understand prior unity. Prior unity is already the case. We don't have, in other words, it's not the goal. Our Adida's goal is not to convince everybody that there's prior unity, and then it is the case. We are one family. What we do have to do is feel how we have failed. The human civilization is in a crisis, and this crisis is about to become catastrophic. How far into the horror do we have to go before we go, we can't act like this anymore? So that won't, you know, I was thinking how there's a lot of movies about what brings the world together, and it's some, you know, transformers appearing from other planets or meteors coming at us, and finally the people get together, right? I mean, that kind of, you didn't have to convince them that, oh, guess what? You should work together because, you know, we're all one. You didn't have to. You just had to see that the world was about to be destroyed. And if we don't start acting like the truth, with the truth, which is that we are one family, we inhere in a universal conscious force, and we can do this. This is not like a high philosophy. Now, the people who are listening have a unique service to perform in this, and that is that they can be agents that connect to others easily, that can be examples of our unity. The prior unity. We don't have
to conscious present. It could be the conscious presence of that,
yeah,
some sensitivity to that prior unity. Yeah.
Right. Right. Exactly. The Adida calls our listeners the service heroes, who are morally enlightened. In other words, we have taken or are trying to practice. We are practicing a level of integrity and responsibility that then can serve others, and we are pretty good communicators. So at first, will everybody be a spiritual practitioner so we can get out of this mess? No. You know, that's kind of, in other words, it's not, this is not an idealistic call that we should all go around, you know, with the one family placards. You know, that's not it. We have to allow everybody to feel we have to have people who can serve many, many other peoples in this. But it's not just a dispersal of a great idea. Adida calls for what he calls the global cooperative forum. In other words, it's not just this great idea that we should all be one family. There is a there is presently a mechanism whereby we all can speak. We all can have, we haven't done it yet, but we can, and that is the internet. Now, the horrible mess that we've gotten ourselves into from insensitive consumerism, nation state posturing, the group identities, the limiting principles of group identity and social identity, all those things are going to kill us all soon. But, and you think, oh, well then, if we just wave enough placards, they'll see it. You know, in other words, we're not saying, governments, change your act. Corporations, be gooder, or whatever. We are saying that won't happen. We will not, no matter how articulate, no matter how passionate we are as with a message, it will not counter the force of thousands of years of egocentric tribalism.
So it's not an idealistic proposition, like let's hold hands together and sing kumbaya.
This is no kumbaya, that's right. What is the only force, Adida points out, that will straighten out the current structures of egocentric, everybody can be fulfilled, everybody can live the good life, and as long now that you're fragmented, I can get you what I can manipulate you like I want to structure that is presently has infiltrated the entire world. And that is if everybody says no. Everybody says no, we can't act like that anymore. If he calls it the everybody all at once. In other words, something that is self-evident. The leaders, I mean, you know, like he points out in the American Revolution, people cried, no taxation without representation is tyranny. And he says that should be a world cry now, because the peoples, the leaders of the world, the corporations and the in-bed corporations with the political powers is tyranny, because it's not representing the people.
Well, yeah, the money politics.
The money politics complex will not be undone by a good idea. It will only be undone if the people, everyone, all at once say, excuse me, we're done. This, the old order is
dead. But that sounds like a prescription for us waiting for the disaster to get bad enough that people kind of wake up and smell the coffee. Isn't there a way that I can be like in my awakening to this prior unity, right here, right now, in my open heart, in my in touchness with the transcendental spiritual reality of being,
mm-hmm.
isn't there a way that I can be that everybody all at once without waiting for everybody else?
Well, yes, and yes, yes, of course. We are fractals, you know, in some sense. When we, each of us, practices unity, so to speak, you know, even in simple terms. I was in San Francisco yesterday and talk about, you know, otherness. There's almost no one looked like me, you know, so to speak. and to actually feel my humanness in my human family.
Your human family, you mean with people of different colors and ethnic and
stripes
other
and
kind of
orientation,
cultural
and
expressions.
All those things,
yeah.
Everything. I can do that, you know, and there is a fractal value in that. In other words, since there is a prior unity by individual spiritual practice, we can have great effect. Just by the persistence in our own spiritual practice, for sure. But we're dealing with a big bad monster here, so to speak. You know, the complex of consumerism, money politics, tribalisms of nations. It's huge. And now, I agree. It's going to get worse before people will notice. How worse? Well, we can only pray not too bad. But if there's nothing in place, if there's nothing in place when the shit hits the proverbial fan, then we go down. So when it starts smelling bad, so to speak, when it starts hitting the fan and there is a global cooperative forum and internet base where everybody can say, no, we're not going to do this. So it behooves us, not just a spiritual, not just a practice in our own spiritual practice and the kind of prayerful fractal forces that we can bring, force that we can't, it does have a great effect. But if we can also, he calls for the creation of a global cooperative forum. And at first, this is going to be the servant heroes. The first council of this will have servant heroes who will be speaking for everyone, not speaking for just their province, not just speaking for their group. We have to have people, a council, a conference that represents everybody and that everybody can participate in.
So what I hear, you know, from my reading of Adida directly too, as well as some of what you're saying right now, is that there's a radical implication of really understanding prior unity, of recognizing that our divided perspectives actually arise from a deeper ground that's undivided, and that coming into an awareness of that undivided ground recontextualizes even our partial perspectives, and our, if we align ourselves more and more fully, in a sense through surrender and through love, with that foundational unity that is always already the case, that we can be more transparent to the inherently self-organizing, inherently self-rightening, inherently self-sustaining, inherently intelligent, inherently healthy nature of being itself. And that this has a lot of subtle expressions, that coming at the idea of unity from a place of separation is never going to do anything. And that this subtle distinction between a deep and profound alignment with the actuality that there really is only one thing going on, only one conscious being who is being all this, only one mystery who is alive as you and me and everyone who is hearing our words, that resting into that ground is a radically different orientation than the divided mind thinking these thoughts and making these distinctions and being very articulate and witty and approaching a unity from a place that's fundamentally feeling separate. And that kind of distinction has a lot of implications that express themselves in all kinds of subtle and important differences in how we actually behave in our lives when we're alone or when we're with other people, and that sensitivity to that distinction is crucial and underrepresented, that there's not that even in the spiritual conversation that difference isn't far forward enough.
Right You're right. If we begin with a goal, in other words, not try to get to prior unity, but make the understanding of how, first of all, come to an understanding of how we are all meditating on ourselves. We've all bought the structure that we're going to be fulfilled, and we're meditating on ourselves egoically, trying to achieve a kind of a personal or a collective satisfaction. The earth cannot sustain that. Everybody is not going to be able to do that. We have to drop our illusions about perfect egoic self-fulfillment, because what that does, it fragments everyone into pursuing their own thing. And as long as we are fragmented, we are manipulatable. You can give me the word there. But
manipulable,
as long as
manipulable.
If long as we are fragmented, it's not going to go anywhere. But and as you pointed out, reality itself is prior unity. So we have to understand our disunity and then naturally presume and understand and feel in the prior unity. That is a great force. Now, we, those of us who have a sense of this, we have then an obligation to be a servant, hero servant, he calls it, who then can help represent everybody all at once and through the Global Cooperative Forum, because it has to take institutional and systematic demands. You know, just having a spiritual movement will be useless. So he calls for a Global Cooperative Forum to replace the absence of systematically responding. The key here is integrity. We have to be not only integral, we have to have integrity. Those servant heroes, those we have to come to a our own disciplined life, our own spiritual practice, full of integrity. And in integrity, we are everyone. We are, we blend with reality itself. On that basis, then we can speak for everyone and have an actual institution, functional, that can speak up against the nation.
So when I try to get a picture of how this Global Cooperative Forum might arise, is this a series of conversations on the internet by people who are taking the point of view of the only legitimate voice here is not the voice of the separate interests of any faction or ethnicity or region over against the whole. It's all about accounting for all the needs of all the different unique expressions of the human family, but from the position of what is going to serve the health of the whole and is on behalf of the whole and the prior unity of all things. And therefore, if you've got a big complex system that's under stress, and there's going to be some pain, and it, the pain, and there might even be, you know, real destruction and you know, terrible losses, it's very hard for the unenlightened individual who happens to be having to see the death of their family to say, oh well, this is part of the natural purification process through which smaller number of people are going to achieve a balanced and sustainable existence on this planet. I'm not sure it's fair to ask you. I don't suppose you really know
how
the global.
No, it's very fair to ask. No, this is not idealism, and it's not naive. It sounds naive to speak of the necessity for childish and brutishly adolescent governments and institutions to understand themselves, you know, oh, can't you just do it? But we don't have another choice. There is no force. There is no force politically, socially as strong as that socio-economic, industrial, military complex other than everybody. So Adi Dab compares it to saying that in the early 19th century, if we were having this conversation in early 19th century Georgia, saying that slavery is wrong, we would be laughed out of the room. But it is true. It's inherently right, and it is going to happen. It's just, I can understand how this seems naive, but if we were all being assaulted by aliens, and we all had to come together, and somebody's brother and half their family just got blown up, it would not be a complex choice to pick up the other sandbag or whatever it is to help against something that's going to destroy us all. And so it sounds like a naive, idealistic proposal, but it is actually the truth. Prior unity is the truth. We are one family, and as soon as we start speaking with a voice, then that voice is stronger, and it is the only thing stronger than the complex, brutish systems that we have now that are failing.
So this whole idea of the Global Cooperative Forum, I mean, I I think what I take on board from this mm-hmm. is that by being a practitioner and being a voice of authenticity, some depth, but also humility, really asking mm-hmm. questions, holding those questions, standing in questions that I don't have answers for, with a passionate care, but that also is rooted in an intuition of the inherent unity, the not-two-ness of existence, that mm-hmm. in that awakened orientation, I am a piece of a global cooperative form. This
that's right.
Beyond Awakening teleseries is one of the pieces of grit in the sand that will be the bricks out of which that global cooperative forum might actually be built. That there's not a particular website that is, there is, a global cooperative forum website. It's probably one of the links that we have up, in the notes on the blog for this announcing this page, this dialogue, the page mm-hmm. announcing this dialogue. But that isn't the only place that this global cooperative forum is manifesting.
It's not an
inherent evolutionary emergent of the whole human phenomenon, right?
That's right. Right. And the sad truth and the wonderful truth is that what other choices do we have? It's not going to work out the way it's going now. This is not a Adi Dom sponsored event of saving the world. No, this is everybody. And
that's why he calls himself in this book. I like this. Is in almost all his writings, Adi Da presents himself as really in the Jehovah archetype, as the I am of God. And he speaks as
Avatar.
God, mm-hmm. Avatar to you, in this mm-hmm, very, mm-hmm, very mm-hmm. strong, invocatory way that basically triggers half the world, more than half the world into total reaction. But which is incredibly transmissive for those who can suspend their disbelief and open their hearts to it. And that's kind of what we were talking about earlier. But now in the Not to His Peace, he calls himself World Friend, which is essentially like, okay, forget about being my student. Let me put my arm around your shoulder and help you. notice where sanity is. Yeah.
Right. Practical wisdom. You don't have to be a devotee, so to speak, of Adi Da, so to speak. You're right. This book, Not to His Pieces, is a sober and thorough analysis of our current situation from a variety of points of view that returns again and again to these three things you were talking about earlier. One, that reality is prior unity. We don't have to achieve it. We are a single family. We don't have to make that our goal. And two, we have to have a global cooperative forum emerge. And three, he calls it like taking the stave or the stick out of the wheel. There will be an inherent rightening that will be wonderful, salvatory, if we take what we're screwing up out of the wheels. In other words, if we understand our tribalistic political systems, we understand our personal illusions for fulfillment. If we take those out of the wheel, there will be a natural rolling forward. So,
you mean if we start showing up as people who don't have the illusion that our lives are about personal fulfillment, but instead
right.
that we're already inhering in something that's happy and joyous and amazing?
Right.
That self-understanding is... Frank, it might be... We're really getting to the point where I want to have our... shift over to the Q&A, but you prepared a clip that you wanted to play, and it's kind of relevant to the point that we were
It
just...
is relevant.
Why don't you introduce that?
Yeah, this is a two little clips, one main one and one little one, my time with him, and it's a not a formal talk. It's in fact we were celebrating and being exuberant with him. But he was speaking to this critical and what he calls root or radical understanding of how I, how this sensation of I who wants to be fulfilled, separates, how one separates oneself, and how this constriction of feeling occurs. That's the, to understand that, this sober and embarrassing, as it were, self-understanding that must precede the full understanding of the prior unity. And so even though this has some sounds of swoons and people saying oohs and ahs and dahs, the informal nature of it aside, or enjoy, he speaks very he speaks perfectly, I think, is one of my favorite talks, to the point of self-understanding, this disunity, separate self-understanding.
Great, great. Well, Brad, could you please play that clip so everyone can hear it?
The only thing that prevents the sublimity in every moment of existence is a simple mechanism of contraction. You must observe it. You must hear me. You must observe it. You must know it thoroughly. So it's not happening to you anymore, so that you know it as your own action. So that you can inquire of it, or meditate beyond it, or feel into the life current, feel into the divine beyond it in your daily life. That's the capability you must regenerate in yourself. You see, it doesn't exist in you now because you've habituated yourself to shut out the force of God. So the first thing you must do is hear me, use my argument, combine yourself with this argument to the point of relieving yourself of the arbitrary notion that things are just happening to you or succumbing to limitation. Realize that these limitations have no force at all. You just respond or react to them. You must see that mechanism of contraction or reactivity. Know it utterly as just like clenching your hand or getting a knot in your stomach or tightening your eyebrows. You must see it exactly as something you do in reaction or response to conditions of existence. When you can know it as such, then you can be responsible for it. And then you will not only experience this baptism, all devotees experience it who turn themselves to me at all, but you will not only experience it, you'll be able to use it, you see, because you'll be responsible for the difference that turns away from it. And then you'll become a devotee, then you'll become a practitioner, you see. You'll move through these slices of time, these technicalities of the various stages, swiftly, directly, you see. The essence of this capability is self-understanding.
What is the truth? We are happy we live in God. The great one is our very being. We inhere in the blissful forcefulness of the starry God. The wonder, the mystery, the person of love. This is our situation and our destiny.
Wow. Well, I hope you were able to hear that. There were some obviously some generations of technical erosion, but his presence and radiance shone through for me. I hope you were able to hear that loud and clear. Well, it's time for us to open up to questions and answers. So if you have a question for Frank or for me, you can send your question via the instant message window in the Instant Teleseminar page on your computer. And if you've dialed in by telephone, just press *2 on your keypad to raise your hand. And if you press it again, it'll lower your hand. So just press it once. If you'd like to find out more about Frank and his work, you can go to frankmorero.com, where you can read 3 of his books and review many other examples of his writings. Particularly notable is Big Philosophy for Little Kids. That's the integrated curriculum for effective development, directed mainly at fifth graders, but it's adaptable for much younger and older kids. There's also the 10 Principles of Spiritual Discipline, which is really a wonderful document for parents of children. The View from Delphi, which is his original book on the ancient Greeks from which he recited, and Songs of Orpheus. And there's another book, Recollections of Socrates, that's not yet publicly available, but it will be soon, and probably just a little bit later this year. If you want to find out more about Adi Da, you can go to the blog entry for this program that's visible at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. And you'll find links to several wonderful sites, including da-peace.com, da-peace.com, which lets you download this whole book, Not to His Peace, and also bzone.com, which is a very rich resource where many essays, talks, and writings are available in written form, as well as audios and videos. And there are a couple of other sites that are mentioned on the blog, and many other worthwhile sites, including the official sites, adidam.org, and many YouTube videos, which are wonderful if you want to check him out that way. I also want to tell you about my online course, Integral Spiritual Practice. I'm just so gratified about what has emerged from the process of creating this course. You know, I've been researching an integral approach to spiritual practice since before I met Adi Da 37 years ago, and I've been teaching it for the last seven. What's obvious to me is how essential a rich and authentic daily practice is to real transformation and even to full human happiness, and how hard it is find their way into a truly human and transformative practice in today's world. It seems like people have to choose between joining cults and hanging out in profane popular culture where the sacred never gets enough traction to really break us through. So I feel like it's been a huge thing to find a way to take people in just eight sessions through a step-by-step process that moves one from being a seeker to being a real practitioner in a way that's uncommon and is grounded in the most radical and embodied wisdom of the world's most highly awakened spiritual realizations, but one that's not a hyper-masculine path of seeking. It's that rarest of paths, a deeply heart-centered, self-compassionate, and humane path that still generates the yogic heat, the tapas that's necessary if you're to really change. A path that engages body, emotions, mind, soul, and spirit in every moment and every aspect of life, but not in a way that's overwhelming. It's in a high-efficiency, simple, doable form that's flexible and not too time-demanding. The first cohort has now finished the course, and I'm just so gratified by what people have been saying to me about how this program has affected their lives. Many have said wonderful things. Many have said that this has been the key for them to bring it all together and really make a transition from feeling like they're wandering and seeking to actually being secure in a real connection that is a practice. We're currently updating it into a form that will be, I think, even a little smoother with audio, video, written materials, wonderful music from Ray Lynch. You can get it now if you'd like, and you'll be able to download the course materials and proceed at your own pace. In a little while, we'll have it updated such that we'll have a more fully functioning community of active practitioners whose lives are really changing. So, and there'll also be an opportunity to get guidance from me as you engage the path. So if you're interested to consider that, please go to your web browser, type in the URL, theispcommunity.com, theispcommunity.com. There's a free download of a little talk by me about some of these things at ispseminar.com. That's Integral Spiritual Practice, ispseminar.com. So it's theispcommunity and ispseminar.com. Please stay on the line. At the end of the call, we'll all open up the phone lines for those of us on the phone, and we can say goodbye and hear each other's voices. Before that, I'll tell you a little more about what's going to be coming up with our upcoming guests, including Andrew Harvey and A.H. Almas, Hamid Ali. Okay, so let's take a look at the questions that have been coming in. I see quite a few of them here in the Instant Teleseminar window, and I see a few hands raised as well. Okay. Well, here's a question from some of these are kind of long. Peter Martin from Chicago asks us two questions. What is the relationship between the principle of prior unity and the principle of the egolessness of reality itself?
Mm-hmm.
And how might egos be brought to appreciate the relationship? And then he also asked if there was a presence of the Global Cooperative Forum on the Internet. I think we answered that, but you may have more to say about that, Frank.
No. Not about that, but his question is correct in the sense that reality itself is egoless. It already is the case. If all egos died, there would still be reality. It's not like it needs it's not the log in the forest that you don't hear it. Reality is already and always the case, and that is egoless. But we don't have to come to some, super advanced spiritual practice. The principle of right and true civilization, or participation in reality, is that we simply assume the disposition of being part of humankind first. If we simply do that, there's a natural egolessness in that. Because we are realizing that we are part of reality, that we're part of humankind. And as we move and presume like that, like this, then there is a natural egolessness, not some super spiritual state of egolessness. There is a natural egolessness in reality itself. He's correct.
Yeah. I think I'd like to add to that. What is most valuable in consulting Adi Da is not anything that can be gleaned from just an analysis of the ideas, but if you open up to his writings or to recordings of him, audio or video, there's a transmission of a clarity of that prior unity that can actually shift your state and open your awareness, such that the idea of the egolessness of reality, which is discussed, beautifully in particularly the Buddhist traditions, but also Hindu and other traditions. This is known by the Sufis, by the Kabbalists. It's not a unique idea from Adi Da. But the idea isn't the point. It's the living presence of that prior unity, that egolessness of being, and the feeling contact with that that's of value. And that is something that Adi Da offers a very, very, nuclear, thermonuclear power kind of intensity of transmission. And that has a special value, and that would probably be the biggest distinction that I'd want to point to.
Mm. What else we got here?
Yeah. Joseph in Paris, France, I guess, kind of wants to challenge us here. He says, even though Adi Da and other gurus have profound and useful things to say, don't you think this guru-centric style of teaching is not only irrelevant, but even an obstacle to human evolution toward enlightened community? That's almost more of a question for me in a way, but do you want to say anything, Frank? I can lean in on that.
Well, I so appreciate, because this was my point of view as well, the skepticism and the untimeliness of gurus, and particularly in Western culture. I wholeheartedly reach out to you and in brotherhood. To say that, to agree with him at first. But every wisdom tradition has a realizer at its root. And I had to get over that. I had to, you know, in my I can do it myself, and I can take heaven by storm modes of myself that I didn't even know about. I had to understand that before I would actually feel the real usefulness of it. So I would tell Joseph, continue with your doubts. Make use of what you can.
Well, yeah, but that's good. You know, let me lean in with some other perspectives, because I'm okay. Really an advocate of this. You know, this very teleseminar is an embodiment of what's sometimes called a post-metaphysical approach. I coined the term meta-sangha, in which I'm really talking about going into an awakening that is collective and a sense of community of awakeners and practitioners that are world-based. So there is something going on right now culturally that I think is extremely important. I would say it's really the roots of the kind of thing that Adi Da is calling a global cooperative forum. I'm trying to serve that through this series. And I think it's tremendously important. I think that people who cling to a doctrinaire and exclusive relationship to Adi Da or any other guru or tradition, and in that I would even include any lineage tradition, will tend to wall themselves off and feel separate from this inherent process that is available to a new kind of collective intelligence, and that therefore, you know, his suspicion has good, you know, I'm kind of agreeing with you that yes, there is something new that's happening that's important, and that does require us to stand kind of naked and unmediated in relation to that prior unity and in relation to one another, not dividing ourselves off, my guru's better than your guru and all that. On the other hand, we need to be the presence of that prior unity in a very powerful way, and we're not going to be able to do that without the powerful presence of the most awakened transmission available. And as you've seen in the dialogues that I've conducted here on this series in Beyond Awakening, I've opened to and kind of chameleon-like flexed into submitting to Byron Katie's work, and then I've resonated with Andrew Harvey, and they're completely contradictory points of view, apparently. And yet each of them is holding real truths, and they are potentizing all of us as we participate with them. Well, Adi Da is a particularly high-voltage source of that kind of transmissive awakening, and so are other gurus. And if we take too much of a judgmental orientation toward what can be gotten from a particularly potent teacher, and we are only focused on what we can do with one another, we're going to be lost in the mind, because the force of ego or you know, the self-contraction is so intense, and the subtleties with which we get lost in the mental perspectives are so insidious and pervasive that blasts of kind of clear light are really important food. So this past generation of great teachers, in which I would also include, in addition to Adi Da, people like his teacher, Baba Muktananda, Chogyam Trungpa, the 16th Karmapa, many of the great Roshis, Suzuki Roshi, and you know, many of whom are criticized for good reasons in other respects. Still, these incredibly potent teachers, Osho, others, have created a wave that has helped to empower what we're doing right now. And even though we can stand in a free relationship and in an autonomous and responsible relationship to the existence itself and to one another, we're going to be a whole lot better able to do our job if we take in these enlightened guru transmissions. That'd be my response to that one.
Well, I wholeheartedly agree with you, but I would say, if you had to choose between doubt and belief, choose doubt. And I heartily encourage doubt, but also have that turn on oneself And all that being said, great, please doubt it, and use it. Expose yourself to it. You don't have to. No one's asking for belief. It's, will you come open-minded, even doubting, but open-minded, to a source of wisdom, and not shun it because you have doubts. Can you, in other words, make the doubt. If you're going to doubt it, great. Doubt's a great tool, but still come.
Have the integrity to doubt your doubt enough that you're actually open to everything that
can
make you more true. Yeah, that's a good response, Frank. Okay, let's take a live question. We have a hand that's been up from Wayne, Michigan. I wonder if this is Sam.
Hi, it is Sam. How you doing, Terry?
Hi, Sam. Welcome.
Hey, great to be with you. And Frank, it's good to be with you as well, brother. How are you today?
Wonderful.
Hi.
So what's your question?
I have a question. I'm curious about this what you're calling the – I forgot what you call it, but it sounds very similar to my ideas about a federation of pulling everybody together. And it's
Global Cooperative Forum? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'm wanting to probe into that a little bit more. As social mood gets worse and worse, it seems like as this crisis is coming, it's more and more likely that we're going to feel more separate and isolated, and we're not working together very well, as you can see with the government and all types of things. Is this Global Cooperative Forum about pulling us together so that we can make some collective decisions as a humanity, as a common brotherhood of what to do? And what are some of your ideas of how we can do this with this event coming closer and closer on the event horizon that we don't know what it is, but it's going to, you know, need something to pull in the opposite direction, it sounds like, of unity?
Thank you, Sam. That's great.
Thank
Frank,
you,
do you have something to say there?
Well, I would say you're right on. And is anything in place yet? Not institutionally, and it's not just suggestions that the Global Cooperative Forum will make. It will be also it needs to come to a place where it's institutionalized and systematized eventually, so that everybody can participate. At first, it's going to be there will be a first council, which has not happened, and that people would these are people of real actual integrity, who can speak for everyone, not just the people the province they represent, will come forth and speak for everyone. Speak for everyone. This is one of the primary qualifications of the first agents in that first council, is they speak for everyone. They understand their own people, the people that they are representing, but they have the depth to be completely embracing of other points of view on all. This has not happened yet. This just must happen. It will happen. We are doing what we can, but people need to be exposed to this and other things. I would recommend people, at that Da Peace website you talked about earlier, Terry, you can download the entire book, Not Two Is Peace, and read the details of what Adi Da has described as this Global Cooperative Forum. It takes up a large sections of the book. So, I mean, that's an incomplete answer. I my apologies, but I can only refer you to the book at this point.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Thanks,
Frank.
Do you
want to say something, Terry? Yeah.
No, I think that my way of relating to the Global Cooperative Forum right now is to say that there's a clarity of vision, particularly in what he has to say about prior unity, everybody all at once, the inherently self-righteousing nature of humanity and existence, that are really clear to me. When it comes to the Global Cooperative Forum itself, I'm just focused on doing the work that a Global Cooperative Forum would do in ways that I see can work. This series is an expression of that. My teaching, my course is an expression of that. I don't know that it's my job right now to try to do a particular institutional thing, but there's some people who are involved with Adi Dham that are contacting, you know, wealthy and influential individuals all around the world, trying to build more and more awareness of the importance of this kind of non-institutionally based, instead of people being representatives of countries and institutions and factions and special interest groups, having them be representatives of wisdom that can account for the breadth of all humanity in a really responsible and trustable way. It's a matter of gathering of mature individuals. And Leo Burke and Carolyn Lee and others are at work in attempting to do that in, you know, from Adi Dham itself. And I'm very hopeful that their efforts are going to be, you know, profoundly effective, but it's kind of behind the scenes. It's not being out there beating the drum and pointing to themselves that they think that they can be effective. And so I see it as an inherent evolutionary emergent more than a particular place you can go on the internet right here, right now.
That's true.
Now let's take another question. Libby Armanino from Placerville, says, you don't see the concept, they and we, any stronger than the classroom environment. Kids' days are systematically set up to further that notion. Sports, teams within the classroom, grades versus grades, etc. I've been working on a curriculum that uses writing to develop a culture of peace and incorporating the integral AQUIL model, AQUIL, Ken Wilber's theoretical model, in my lesson planning. I think this idea of bringing of prior unity might be an idea that I can still bring in. My question is, Frank, are you still teaching? And other than incorporating moral and character development through Socratic questioning strategies for changing or reaffirming perspective taking, how else might a teacher bring in the notion of prior unity?
Well, that's great. She should go to frankmoreau.com and email me. We'll have a longer conversation. And then also go look in depth at Big Philosophy for Little Kids to see all the details of the way I do it every day. But I one of the things that I really enjoy, by the way, in Not to His Peace, Adi Dham has an entire section on what he calls zero point education. And how we do need to transform education from the make more workers for the military industrial complex model of education to having people who understand that we live in this world with everybody. One of the things I do in a classroom, we have to study the diaspora and the spreading of humans across the planet, and we talk about a mitochondrial Eve and how we all have a common grandmother, great 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 grandmother, etc. We can talk about the one family that we do have, and it's very nice because I'm from the old ancient times when I had segregated schools where I grew up, and I teach in a classroom that's thoroughly rainbow coalition. And we talk about how we are one family. We look around at each other and call each other cousin. And there's ways to do that as well. My wife, who teaches sixth grade, has a fantastic lesson where she puts a bunch of M&Ms in a cup. And she says, this is a renewable resource. And you can have as much, but if it's all gone, It doesn't renew, and you can have as many as you want. And you pass it, or you know, it has different groups pass them around. They each have several groups, and they pass them around. And the kids that take them all, they run out. But every time it goes around, there's still some left. More get added, and they see very quickly if they take all of it, it doesn't renew. And some kids are left without M&Ms. And the other thing she does is she takes up a big potato thing of potato chips, and she divides the class into four groups, first generation, second generation, third generation, and fourth generation, and says, this is a non-renewable resource, like oil, oily potato chips. Have as much as you want, and then the other people, the other groups, are your children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Take as much as you want, and then pass it on to the next group. And you can imagine what happens in the discussion that comes about. So there needs to be a wide use of education is key for the Global Cooperative Forum. It's one of the main functions we have is to re-educate ourselves to being with each other rather than in mere competition. Now, as Ali Dahl also points out in Not Two His Peace, that there are some places for competition. It's fine. Competition has a great purpose in, as he points out, in a context of everybody. In other words, we can have a great football game with the other football team because we're developing our skills in that kind of arena, literally. But when we're all done, we enjoy each other as friends and family. So there's places for competition, but it has to be done in the context of prior unity. And education is huge. She's exactly right. And I am
great.
Still teaching every day.
Great. Well, we've got another hand in the air from somewhere nearby, from San Rafael, California. Okay, you're on the air. Please introduce yourself. 4920930, hello?
Hi, Frank.
Deborah?
And Terry. Frank, it's Deborah.
Yes.
I'm really enjoying the conversation today, and as I've been listening, there's one thing that I have been really kind of keen into, and it is about this something that Terry spoke to about people who are experiencing real suffering and not being idealistic in the face of that. And so I was thinking about I always feel like I'm saying his last name wrong, Brother David
Steindl-Rast.
Rast, thank you. I had the pleasure of meeting him on many occasions through my work, and he spoke about actually the transformative power of suffering and how he's had such a personal experience in going into circumstances where people have suffered greatly and actually them finding a level of gratitude for the experience and it transforming their understanding about their limited understanding about their place in humanity and actually it taking them to a depth of sensitivity to the interconnectedness of all of us as a human family and with a much larger reality. And I've seen that really firsthand as well in my own work in nonprofits and working with people who are very high-risk audience, hungry and homeless, and them experiencing incredible atrocities in their life and then being very transformed and actually finding gratitude in the midst of it. And so as I was listening to that and then thinking about what happens on the planet as well, Frank, I love you bringing the element of the story, and you refer to movies and story about people actually coming together in the face of crisis. That's happened quite a few times on the planet in real life circumstances. And so there's this whole matter of like the grace of suffering and what it can bring us to. And so I'm wondering if you could speak to that a little bit, because I know Adi Dawes spoke to it a lot, and how it can move us beyond our separative, not that it's a bad thing to be a unique, individuated individual. It's not. That's a healthy thing. But beyond the separativeness, if you could speak to that a little bit.
Well,
thanks,
the only thing that comes to mind, Deborah, is when have we all been together as a planet? The aliens haven't come yet to have us do that, and nor is a meteor shooting at us, although one's coming close out here soon. But it is the early years of the space program, and I remember how the entire world stopped. It's the landing of the moon when Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. But and I don't know if you also know when they first put up satellites into outer space. I remember it well, and they had the first global communication, and they asked people around the world to what would be their first global communication, and John Lennon wrote All You Need Is Love for that occasion. So those are the only two that come to mind. Do you have others in mind, Terry or Deborah?
Well, Well, I'm glad that you mentioned the space program, because I've had the privilege of meeting an astronaut who actually walked on the moon. And
oh, wow.
And he spoke about that, about coming back then and traveling the planet and just the whole planet being in ecstatic response to what had occurred and feeling
mm-hmm.
it. It took him beyond, it was a really epiphany moment for him. It took him beyond all the scientific training he had as an engineer and a physicist, and he started to plug into a realization that there was so much more happening than any of us were actually aware of from a kind of scientific materialist point of view. And so, but the other things I'm thinking about are things that have been like crisis, where people's hearts have been broken. And in that heartbroken space, they've actually moved beyond their usual sense of separateness and limitation. You know, I mean, just looking at the incredible global response to, you know, when Princess Di had her death, when Mother Teresa, when there's been catastrophic occurrences on the planet where people have had to actually really go beyond their sense of, I'm only going to take care of myself. I mean, the most more recent one I'm thinking of is like the whole the thing happened with the miners down in, was it in Peru?
Oh, yeah, Chile.
So it's those kind of things that they things are happening on a regular basis.
You're right.
You know?
You're exactly right. We tend to think of our current events like we think of history. And history is written by governments, not by people, you know. And we don't. What is the real story? I remember being so heartened in 1989 at the San Francisco earthquake when a village in Africa sent us $27. It was just like, oh my God, you're right. People, there is a real sense of our unity. That's great.
I think to me, when I think about the Global Cooperative Forum, then there is a way where there are things that have occurred on the planet that are almost could be called best practices that we can chronicle and actually align and combine with in a greater way that is a platform for us to springboard off of. So that's just what I wanted to bring to the conversation. Thank you guys so much.
That's really great, Deborah. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Frank, I feel like we've barely begun, but we're kind of at the end of our time. So before I tell you a little about what's coming up in a few weeks and open up the lines so we can say goodbye and hear each other's voices, a few reminders. If you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it and registering for this series and inviting them to register for it. You can do that at beyondawakeningseries.com, beyondawakeningseries.com. And please also consider supporting my work and enriching your life by taking my course in integral spiritual practice, which you can look at, as I told you, at theispcommunity.com, and you can download a free audio of me describing the three essential practices of an integral spiritual life at ispseminar.com. And if you want to learn more about my other work or see videos, audios, or other writings from me, visit integralspiritualpractice.com. I also want to tell you about the course, Awakening to an Evolutionary Relationship to Life, with Integral Enlightenment founder and teacher Craig Hamilton. In this 9-week virtual course, The Essential Course for Evolutionaries, you'll discover the liberating principles and practices of integral evolutionary spirituality, explore new vistas of possibility, and find support for your own process of evolutionary transformation. The course begins Wednesday of this week, June 28th, 2011. So if you're interested, register today at academyforevolutionaries.com. That's academyforevolutionaries.com. Now, we're going to take an extra week off because of the July 4th weekend here in the United States. So our next dialogue won't be until July 17th, when I'll be having a second dialogue with Andrew Harvey. Many of you have tuned into my first dialogue with him on Mother's Day, which was quite passionate and amazing. I felt moved to invite him back because I felt like we had just begun, and so we're calling this next one Passion and Evolution. But that dialogue will not be at our usual morning time. here in California. So please mark your calendar. This one will be at 5:30 p.m. instead of 10 a.m. Pacific time. So it'll be more difficult for our European friends, but more accessible for our listeners on the other side of the Pacific. Our dialogues for August will be announced soon. In September, I'll be dialoguing with A.H. Almas, Hamid Ali, the founder of the Diamond Heart School, and there are many other remarkable conversations that we'll be having in the time ahead. So thanks so much for joining Frank and me today. Let's open up our phone lines so everybody can hear each other's voices and say goodbye.
Hey, hey.
Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye, Terry.
Bye,
Terry.
Bye, everybody.
God bless. Wow. Thank
God
you.
God bless.
Oh,
yeah,
my
goodness.
Bye. Thank you, Terry.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you. Da.